Hi, Bill Tabone here, co-founder of the Australian Paranormal Society and author of Ghosts of Airedale Asylum. And you're listening to Ghosts in the Valley podcast. Enjoy.
Ghosts, spirits, demons, poltergeists, UFOs, aliens, Bigfoot, Dogman, Mothman, cryptids, Yeti, Wendigo, the Fae, doppelgangers, psychics, mediums, witches, pagan, Reiki, spiritualism, seances, past life, life after death, black-eyed kids, white-eyed kids, Ouija boards, exorcists, smudging, sage, incense, haint blue, curses, 411, abductions, converse werewolf.
Ghost in the Valley Podcast.
I'm Al Cooley, host of Ghost in the Valley podcast. Today, I'm stepping out of the realm just a little bit. This is such a cool story. I mean, I've seen her on other podcasts. I've come across her on different links on the social media. I said, man, I'm going to try to get her on the show. And she agreed. I'm so thrilled that she did. I'm gonna say her name. I hope I don't butcher it. Teodora Hajiska. And I'm going to call her Teddy. She's a traveler. She's an explorer. She's a mountaineer. And most of all, she's a survivor. That's so important. That's to survive whatever trauma you have in your life or injuries or stuff that comes your way. And I'm going to let her tell this story, man. I mean, I think she's so interesting. I'm so glad that you're on the show. Welcome to the show. I'm going to call you Teddy. Is that okay?
Yes, Al. Hi to everybody.
You know, I see you were born in Bulgaria. You're raised in Cuba, and you spent 10 years in the United States. That's where I'm at. And you're currently in Austria.
Correct. Yes.
Did you pick up your English in the USA or before that?
USA, because I tried learning English in every institution I could find in Bulgaria because I wanted so badly to go to the US. And then the first 2 years, I was like using all of the vocabulary that I learned. And the Americans are like, what?
Yeah.
Because you have a way to do a lot of words by combining shorter, simpler words. Mm-hmm. That have their equivalent in much elaborate words in the dictionary because you have a very rich language, but you don't use it. I mean, you know what it is if you read it, but you don't use it in everyday's, you know.
Right. Yeah, and you have one word that means two things, you know. I mean, that can be confusing. You know, a lot of words that describe two things.
I know.
Yeah.
So, the English. So basically, I know Bulgarian, my mother tongue, and then the Spanish is engraved in my brain forever because this is what the first memories are from there. And then the United States. I love the United States. The only reason I live in Austria is because I just went back to Bulgaria for something, passport or something. And I met my husband, who is a traveler. And because I cannot do it on my own, it's like, well, we didn't marry, actually. That was the person who was with me, the back of the truck that we almost died.
Oh, so he's with you from there. Yeah, we're going to get into that, too. Yeah, that's such an interesting story.
Like every story I start in about my life, and in general, when I speak to people, up to the third sentence, I'm back to the Dyatlov Pass. That's so weird. I mean, it's like I always end up with the Dyatlov Pass.
I mean, you're out there exploring, going down different paths to find something. I know what you're looking for. You're like I always had questions. Why do hikers or explorers do what they do? You're gonna risk going up on a mountain
I'll tell you right away, because in the civilization, all the problems psychologically, everything is so complicated. It's like 1 minute you're happy, the next minute you're annoyed, you want to kill this person, then you love this person. And in the mountain, it's so simple. You just need to get from point A to point B to outrun the bear. I mean, not to meet the bear because you cannot outrun it, to have enough water, not to get lost, not to die from hypothermia. And that's all that makes you happy. Simple things. In the mountain, everything is so simple and so beautiful. The only thing that can spoil the mountain is other people. That's why I prefer to go where there are no crowds, there are no groups, there are no permits. I mean, in the States, it's a different story if we speak about permits. The permit system in the States is a very good one because you have made the mountains national parks, and you actually regulate with the permits how many people are going to camp in certain spots. So that's a good thing. That actually helps avoid the crowd, and you need the permits and all the lotteries about the permits. And I love this system. While in India, for example, it's all about who gets paid and who. So there is a, I mean, it started as a good idea for the Himalayas because people just, the tourists, the white tourists get lost and they die there and there are no resources to find them and blah, blah. But right now it's all very corrupted because it's they give the licenses to guides that only they control that. And they give you permits where to go. They don't clean. They don't care at all. They just want the groups to go under their control. And then if you just go to the next quebrada, which is the next ravine into the mountain, which is like the next wrinkle of the mountain, there is no permit needed. But so this is how we go there. And this is how I do. The only condition that I have to go in the mountains, so there are no other people there. So don't ask me about if my dream is about Everest. No. Places where it's so commercialized, everything. It's not that I don't love it. It's just too many people. I go to the mountain to avoid people. So why go there where everybody goes? And also, this is very important. I don't work. I don't have kids. I don't have family, I don't have pets, I don't even have flowers. So I can go whenever I want to.
All right. Free spirit, I like that.
Yeah.
Man, I read your thing here about and what happened to you in 2012 on July 14th. Take us into this horrific accident you were involved with in the years of, the reconstructive surgery and everything you went through.
Well, no one wants to take risks, or everybody knows that going into the mountain is dangerous stuff, but because I don't climb with ropes, I don't do anything that speeds, I don't even ride a bicycle. I'm so afraid of speed, not because something had happened to me before that accident, but just because maybe it's a control freak thing that I need to be in control of the tank. And when you are speeding up, you're out of control. That's why I'm afraid of flying, and I fly all the time, but I'm afraid of flying. And this is something to do about not having the control over the airplane. So going to the mountain, you don't expect anything bad to happen if you don't do dangerous stuff. At some point, I started going to volcanoes. I fell in love with volcanoes because those are not very tall. I mean, the active ones. And I don't climb down the craters, and I don't go to be exposed to the lava and the spewing and so on. And they're kind of in very beautiful places, the Philippines, the Indonesia. Indonesia became my favorite country. So on my second, third expedition there, and we go to volcanoes, not like Borneo or the beautiful ones. The beautiful ones we see from far away, but we go into those that are no one wants to go there, and there are so many. So we went to Karangatan, and that's on a very small island, Siau. No one goes there, so no tourists, no transportation, no logistics, no restaurants, no nothing. So we went. It was an active volcano. It was spewing some the ash and smoke. So we saw it from wherever. It was a jungle. There are no trails. And then on the way back to the ship we had to
get on the harbor. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We just hitchhiked. We started pleading to a driver of a truck that was full with bricks and irons and construction materials like sand to take us to the harbor because there was no buses or anything. And we're going to miss our ship. And he said, I don't have any place to put you because in the cabin we're already three people. So we went in the back of the truck and we were like having the. So this is what I meant when you don't think you're taking any risk, like going on the back of a truck with your backpacks is all fun, right?
Right.
The wind is in your hair and you're okay. Nothing danger doesn't seem to be dangerous. But the brake gave up, so it was a runaway truck with iron and construction materials, and it was down a volcano. So all it's alive. This truck had never seen actually even road, paved road. It's always up and down, up and down. So he was going down, and later someone told us, because I lost consciousness, so I couldn't talk to the driver or anybody who was in the vehicle after the incident. I was unconscious because I had subdural hematoma, so the blood was actually bleeding in my brain. But after that, they explained to us that because there are no ramps for runaway trucks like they usually do on freeways and places where it's more civilized. So they teach the drivers if the brakes stop working to just jump out of the truck. But he couldn't jump because he had us in the back. Mm-hmm. And because we felt that the truck is out of control, and I started holding with my both hands to the rail. And if I saw the driver jumping out of the truck, I would be like, all right. I was on the side of the void. So I was, even if I attempted to jump, that's not an easy thing to jump from a truck when you don't expect it, because at the moment you realize you're going to die in a moment, you're already with 80 kilometers per hour. So this like no control. The truck could not take the turns in four wheels. He was already on two wheels and the driver just smashed, and it was a quick thinking. He smashed the truck into the face of the mountain so we don't fall in the abyss, in the void. Yeah. So he smashed it bad. I mean, it was like all was destroyed. And they flew from the cabin, from the front shield, but they didn't die. They called the ambulance. He actually called his employer, and the employer called the ambulance and then paid for our transportation. There was a doctor with me, and so I was the only thing I remember. The last thing was like, okay, we're dying now. It was fun. The next thing that I'm vomiting because of the I had concussion. And you're flat. And that has something to do with the Dyatlov Pass, because later on, I didn't know anything about no Dyatlov, nothing. That name, I didn't know. I haven't heard it before. But in the they took me to a very small hospital. They didn't even have an x-ray machine. So they only knew that I shouldn't be moved and that I'm dying, because I don't know how they knew without the x-ray, but they knew that I'm all broken.
We were breathing, probably aspirating.
I don't know, but they knew that they shouldn't move me. They said she has to go to a bigger hospital. We can't do anything here. So they put me in the cargo of a ship. And the ship went to mainland Sulawesi, and they couldn't even take me out because it was too heavy. So they had to unload the cargo so it can bring up, so they can take me on the ramp. Otherwise, I would be very crooked to be transported. So they took me to that hospital. The hospital said, okay, she's all broken and she's dying. We cannot open her because we don't have the resources. My rib cage had to be open, and all of the pieces of my ribs had to be stapled they couldn't do that. In addition to the subdural hematoma, and my elbow was shattered, but that wasn't anything that they were even bothered about. So they just watched me for 5 days, because this is the critical for flail chest. You actually drown in your own blood in mm-hmm. the fourth or fifth day. And I had a very young girl next to me. Her name was Indri, and we were sharing the thing that measures in your finger the oxygen in the blood mm-hmm. and what's called. So we were sharing that, and she had her accident one day before me, and she was on her phone listening to music. She had some head trauma, but I thought she's better than me. And one night she just started coughing, and they just fill you with all the pills so you don't sneeze and cough when your ribcage is broken. Mm-hmm. They give you medicine so you don't cough, because it hurts and it can dislodge some of the edges of the sharp bones. They can pierce your organs, so you're not supposed to, and it hurts like hell mm-hmm. if you sneeze or cough. So she started coughing very badly at 3 a.m. I remember, and I started calling her, and she died. So the next day they were just looking at me and asked me if I want a priest. And I got very angry then, because I wasn't ready to die. This is how when you have you heard all the movie Touching the Void, the guy whose rope was cut off. There were I think Cordillera Blanca. I went to that place where it happened. So the incident is the precedent when two climbers were roped. And then one of them broke his leg, and then he hung from a crevice, and the other one was waiting for any signs of life, and then he cut his rope. And the one that was hanging on the rope, he fell into the crevice, into the ice, and he was with broken legs and everything. And when he came around, he thought, okay, so now I'm going to pull the rope, and they're going to bring me out. And then he saw that the rope fell down and it was cut. And he was so pissed off, so pissed off. And I knew. And then, I mean, before I watched this movie, I just remember that detail. And I felt the same way. But when you're so pissed off, that means you have the energy to actually fight your life.
Fight for your life, right. So that's like a survivor.
Yeah, when you get angry, this is when you have the, mm-hmm. and this is what I, that's not my only incident. Well, that was the near-death incident. So what happened is that I didn't die. And then after 2-3 weeks, they said she should be evacuated to even better place. I mean, back to Europe, but I didn't have the money. So we gathered only money to Kuala Lumpur, and then they watched me some more. And at the end, when I didn't die from the flail chest and the lung injury and everything, they said, well, let's operate on your arm. And since then, I have been in and out, 7 surgeries to make elbow on my left hand. So that's why I have so much surgeries. It's just for the arm. They never open the rib cage. And every time when someone sees me, to this day, the x-rays, they just stand up and ask me for permission to show my x-rays on lectures to show how it can heal. I mean, I'm not healed. I'm all broken. But just the edges, they have calluses of the bones that are just everywhere in my ribcage. And it's just up to the muscles to keep opening the ribcage when I'm inhaling. So I didn't much change my life, my hiking routine, other than I swear a lot now, because when I still carry a very heavy backpack, but I'm in a very bad mood. I curse on every step, but I still go.
Well, I just seen those pictures you sent me, right? And I'm like, just like construction screws in your elbow and a plate. Then you said you could like a bionic woman with the, you can see the metal out of your elbow. And
so let's just tell you When I heard for the first time the word Dyatlov, it was in Serdang hospital, and someone said, are you coming from Dyatlov Pass? I was under morphine then. I mean, I had a lot of morphine, and I had morphine because they operated on my elbow for the first time, and it was, I mean, the first surgery. It was so bad. I mean, so bad. Maybe because I was in a thoracic wing or something. So actually, they couldn't do, and elbow is one of the joints that are very hard to operate on, almost like an ankle, like a knee or an ankle. And actually, from time to time, I go to for a consultation in Vegas. I went to, I paid like $400 to consult if there are any new ways, methods to help my elbow to open, because even after all the reconstructions, after 7 surgeries, it still doesn't have the motion range. I mean, I can't fully open it.
This episode is brought to you by Spreaker, the platform responsible for a rapidly spreading condition known as podcast brain. Symptoms include buying microphones you don't need, explaining RSS feeds to confused relatives, and saying things like, sorry, I can't talk right now, I'm editing audio. If this sounds familiar, you're probably already a podcaster. The good news is Spreaker makes the whole process simple. You record your show, upload it once, and Spreaker distributes it everywhere people listen. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and about a dozen apps your cousin swears are the next big thing. Even better, Spreaker helps you monetize your show with ads, meaning your podcast might someday pay for, well, more microphones. Start your show today at Spreaker.com. Spreaker, because if you're going to talk to yourself for an hour, you might as well publish it.
They told me, well, how many operations did you have? 7. And did you feel any better? And I said, no. Ah, in the clinic that I went to, they had a big sign. We only do elbows, no knees. Sometimes they make a joke. Well, this is only for left elbow, not for the right elbow. You have to go someplace. I mean, it's very unique thing. It's very strange. Even after the reconstruction, even after they replace it or something like that, then the brain can employ some mechanism to prevent you from actually having a full range of motion. It's weird. They said, are you coming from Dyatlov? I had morphine in me, and I just remember the name. Or actually, I asked my friend to, what were they asking me about? And he said, yeah, that's a real thing. You should check it out. So this is how I first heard about Dyatlov. And about the photos that you said, well, my first operation was with some parts that are supposedly done for this purpose. But then I start rotting. I mean, I had the, what do you call it? Necrosis. So my bones started necroting from the inside. So I had horrific pain. I smelled like fish, and there were all kinds of insects. I was attracting insects as if my lymph was dying. And no. I was starting to have a decomposition. That's exactly what was happening. So I went to Vienna, and they wanted to replace my joint with metal. I said, no way. And I went back to Bulgaria. And in Bulgaria, because they don't have that many parts, or it's not like Vienna, which was supposed to be better, but not for me. So in Bulgaria, they experimented. Well, that could be a good thing and bad thing, of course, to experiment on you. Yeah. And the problem, the uniqueness of this injury is that usually after an air crash, they take you to the operation table in hours. I was praying not to die I was cursing not to die for 3 weeks. They operated my elbow after I didn't die from a flail chest. And I have to tell you, if we're on the topic, I have to tell you about my subdural hematoma in my brain. I started seeing things. I started seeing zombies. Wow. I had part of the brain was filled with blood and didn't interpret the data that was coming from my eyes. So the next areas were taking over, and they were making stuff. Like, instead of seeing a black space in front of you, or somewhere on the left was in my case, instead of gray, black, whatever, like, okay, I don't see what's there, my brain actually did painted something there, like a third eye or another arm coming out from your back or something like that. And I was in a thoracic wing where there were people coming from accidents, and they were really broken. But then I saw people that were their relatives and coming to visit, but they were also twisted. Like, I mean, really, you see a face like Picasso, or you see an arm that's coming from your scapula, or like the leg is actually turned the other way around. And those are not patients, those are visitors. But that happens only when they're on a certain distance from you. And I didn't have any pain then, but I was seeing all these things. And at some point I started asking, what's happening? Why are everybody so broken and twisted? So they took me to them to examine me. And they said, well, we have to drill your skull to relieve the pressure, the blood that's filling your brain, if that doesn't improve. So I was scheduled to do that, but I didn't come to that. I mean, the blood went away on its own. It was really bad for a week. I was surrounded by zombies. And then after that, I saw a three-legged chair. And I was like, so startled again. I looked at my friend and he said, it has three legs. It's three legs.
Oh, yeah. You don't know what you're looking at, you know?
So after I went to Bulgaria, they started doing my elbow. They experimented with screws and parts from a bicycle.
Looked like drywall screws to me, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But those, they actually kept inside. And the fancy ones that I paid dearly in Kuala Lumpur, they start sticking out from my skin. And in Vienna, where I live now, I went and showed them the shiny metal part they put in Kuala Lumpur. It was sticking out of my skin because I didn't have appointment. I was telling at the reception because I had bandage over that. And I said, I have a problem. They said, oh, what's your name? What's your health insurance? Blah, blah, blah. So they were asking a lot of questions. And then I unwrapped this to show them what's my problem. And then they just said, who put that there? I said, well, I don't know, you have to take it out. And they couldn't bother with my name. Like, right now you try to pronounce my name. And they're like, ha. And they called me Robocop. So Robocop to come here. So they took it out. They expected that
this. I actually did pretty good then, didn't I? Right.
Yeah, you did good. But they didn't try. They were too startled to try. So they took out all the metal that was sticking out and didn't need to be there. They told me that I should put some fat on my elbow. I mean, how do you put fat on your elbow? You start with your stomach, your butt. By the time it gets to your elbow, you're going to be like Michelin.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's how I heard Dyatlov Pass for the first time. They asked me if I'm coming from there, meaning that my chest was all broken. And then, so how it all started, I wanted to learn what is this, who are these people, how they died. And I just, my life was circling the drain, right? I was like dying. And then suddenly I saw the light of the tunnel. It turns out that everything that I lost, like couldn't go to the mountain for a very long time. I lost, so a lot of things changed in my life. I stopped working. I didn't care about family anymore. I didn't care about nothing. And it turned out that my drain that was my life was circling around is actually the rabbit hole of the Dyatlov Pass. Ever since that time, this incident, 13 years.
How do you say that? Dyatlov? Is that how you say that?
It's okay. Dyatlov. Dyatlov. Dyatlov, because the leader of this group is Igor Dyatlov.
We're going to stop at this point and continue next week with Teddy's amazing story on the Gatlov Pass. She's done a lot of research. She's been there. We'll have her theories on how these hikers died on that snow blustery evening in 1959, because a lot of theories are out there on how these hikers were tragically died. Was it an avalanche, abominable snowman, UFO? So many stories, so many theories. We're going to get Teddy's opinions, her thoughts. So please come back next week with part two of my conversation with Teodora Hajiskas. I'm your host, Al Cooley, host of Ghost in the Valley podcast.